Hi, I'm Spencer.
And I'm Andrew.
And we're here at the Slowdown's New York headquarters. You're listening to Time Sensitive, a podcast where we profile curious and courageous people in business, the arts, and beyond who have found a distinct perspective on time.
So this week we have Liz Diller on the podcast, a New York local hero. What did you guys talk about?
I should say very New York and very local hero. Her studio is actually a block away from here. And she's designed several of the things we see out the window, the High Line, the shed at Hudson Yards, a new tower at Hudson Yards. We talked about a lot of different things related to her career, which now spans several decades. But really, we focused a lot on New York City. And I can't think of that many people who are better to talk about New York City right now than Liz. She actually joked on the episode that walking around the city is kind of like one big punch list for her. and not surprisingly, I mean, she's doing the expansion for MoMA in Midtown and recently completed building up at Columbia. So she really has built a lot here and she grew up here. She's a hometown hero.
Who doesn't love a New York conversation? Let's get into it.
So Liz, welcome to Time Sensitive. It's great to have you here today.
Good to be here.
I wanted to start on the subject of painting and sculpture because I understand that before becoming an architect, before becoming interested in film, and we'll touch on that, you were really interested in painting and sculpture. Where did that come from?
You know, I have absolutely no idea. I just thought it would be nice to do some still lives. And I don't know how this came to me. I was a kid. I was probably 8 years old or so. And my parents got me into these classes, these art classes, painting classes. And I learned a little bit how to paint figural paintings and still lives. And I realized that's not exactly where I want to be. But I did have, my parents encouraged my artistic desires, even though I didn't know where they wanted to go.
And you also became engaged in photography. Did that stem out of this sort of work you were doing or exploration you were doing in painting and sculpture? Or,
well, by the time I got to high school, I was at the High School of Music and Art in New York, and it was one of the five special schools. And it was a time of a lot of unrest, student unrest. So I remember mostly about being liberated from school and protesting and anti-war efforts. That was really the first time I was exposed to a kind of more serious view. And I started to delve into photography and filmmaking. But, you know, whatever you can do with a Super 8 at that time. And my father had a camera that I just sort of took and started to make photos. And I realized that it was kind of a nice way to express oneself.
And this was the late 60s or?
No, that was, well, let's see. That must have been in the very late 60s, early 70s.
And this led to an interest in film. I understand that that was sort of, once you kind of figured, oh, I could have a career, you were thinking that maybe being a filmmaker was something.
Yeah, so photography stuck with me a little bit and the desire to make experimental films. So at that time, we're talking about Stan Brakhage and people like that. And that was really the beginning of the public theater, the Anthology Film Archives. I was always going there and I was exposed to independent film. I wanted to go at that point to Cooper Union and I had to make my way in. So that was a little bit of a challenge, but I got in. And at Cooper, I continued to pursue filmmaking and photography as well as other media.
And film was sort of a outlet for you that somehow led to architecture, or how did architecture come into this?
Yeah, so film, and not in the classical narrative sense, right? Not necessarily storytelling, but it was a medium that was time-based, where it was very interesting to manipulate space, flatness and dimensionality, just in celluloid. So I was very much taken by that. Hollis Frampton was one of the faculty members. I was really enthused by independent film, an experimental film. This was a time in the mid to later 70s where I was sort of caught between what was going on in the sort of the art scene in Soho and the Village. And there were so many artists that were there and that were breaking boundaries and a lot going on in the music scene and crossover work in all media. And I was really interested in installation, and I became more and more sort of out of the celluloid, but into space and into concerns about space. At some point, while I was at Cooper, I decided to take this class called Architectonics in the architecture school. And mostly because I didn't know what it meant, and I thought that was intriguing. And I just enrolled in that class. And, you know, by the way, to this day, I don't know what it means. But it was there that I first met John Hadak, who was the dean of the school. And he was a kind of independent mind guru, poet, and architect. And I somehow got swallowed by that whole, like, his work, his attitude, which was totally anti-professional architecture, but it was more about the depth of the discipline and how the discipline is a cultural one. And it crosses over literature and painting and, you know, all the references that were put in front of us, 20th century references. So I was really intrigued by the discourse in the School of Architecture and decided to transfer and get my degree in architecture rather than in art, but without any real desire to be an architect.
Yeah, and it sounds like part of that decision was also understanding that you had all these other interests that you could bring into architecture, that you could look at it through sort of a film lens or...
Exactly. So architecture was just one outlet, and it was a way of thinking about real time and real space in the public, with the public. So I was interested in the conventions of everyday operational space and how I could screw around with it. So it was sort of an art practice and an architecture practice at the same time. I always thought it was architecture, that early work, because it was about the discipline, and not necessarily the profession. But I had felt when I was in school that the profession was just intellectually bankrupt, and it was just something that I wasn't interested in pursuing. So it was always sort of adding just one more tool to the toolkit to think about space and to have a little bit of an education around the history of the discipline so that I could sort of know my way around.
Can you elaborate a little bit on intellectually bankrupt?
Well, it was a time when I was in school where professional architecture was, there was no discursive part of it. It was really professional work. It was repeating what had been inherited over decades. And without really, you know, I think that maybe there was some inspiration from the work of Mies. But at that point, it was already corrupted. You know, it wasn't with Mies's original intention. So there were very few references. And the references that I had as a student of contemporary architects were really doing alternative work, like Rem Koolhaas and Bernard Tschumi and Danny Liebeskind. Zaha was just starting. It was, they were doing alternative work on paper, in print, in galleries, and in academia. So nobody was really building at the time. People that were interested in ideas were putting them out in other forms because there were very few opportunities to build.
Mm. Yeah, and this was before the shift where the so-called paper architects actually finally had the technological tools to make and do. I'm curious about this time from a mediated experience sort of perspective, because a lot of your work deals with the mediated experience. And was that something you were paying attention to? Was media at the time, and how you might bring that into architecture?
You know, some of the work that I did with Rick really, really early on was with Creative Time. And also, so these were installations in different parts of the city. So it's the same Creative Time it's still there and still doing independent work. Also, Creation Production Companies. This was a young theater collective, and the members were really, really smart, and we were engaging with them. And it was something between performance art and theater. So at La Mama, for example, and interventions in the Brooklyn Bridge Anchorage, and spaces like that, alternative spaces for theatrical productions. And in doing that work, we became very interested in what the relationship between the stage and the audience, and thinking about issues about liveness. That is, you know, it was a time that there was media was everywhere already, different kinds of media. And it was an opportunity to think about authenticity. And that was something that really came from John Haydock. I was always skeptical about that word and what authentic really meant. And in the terms that he said it, there was authentic was good and inauthentic was everything bad. And I was rebellious, and I was pretty interested in, you know, how these terms were sort of polarizing our view of the world and what were the gray areas. So that's when I became interested in liveness on the stage, this like physical connection with the audience and performers, but also bringing mediated presences to the stage. And one of the very early projects just had a big mirror over the stage at 45 degrees and presented two views of the same character, one natural, physical, that you see in deep space, and one mediated from above. So through the mirror. So we were looking at the same live performance, but not directly. And this allowed certain kind of new possibilities to happen. So if the character decided to lie on the floor, they would appear floating in the air, because they would be rotated 90 degrees by the mirror. And that set up a kind of really interesting conversation, physical space around what the audience could see, how they had to sort of think a little bit and sort of playing around with the stage. And that led also to other kinds of mediation, like video, and pushing the abilities of performers to do extra special things, go beyond their physical limitations to digital possibilities. So all these sort of projects, one rolled out of another, rolled out of another. And that also worked its way into architectural
ideas. I was going to mention in 1991, it's an unrealized project, but it was one of the early ones that captured a lot of media attention, Slow House, where you kind of created this mediated view. Tell the listeners a little bit about what this project was and what were you trying to achieve as an architect, combining a filmed experience and then a real life sort of home.
Yes. So this was, I think we got the commission in probably 89 or something like that, maybe 88. And this was the first time that I had a hope that I could actually execute ideas in architecture with a client, you know, under the sort of professional terms with a budget and a timetable and all of that. And it was a house, a private house. It was near the Hamptons, and it was on the bay. And Rick and I became fascinated by the notion of a view and having a view of the water, and how a view isn't a view until you frame it. So you could basically be on the edge of a bluff looking out, and you see the sea and you see the horizon. But it isn't until you make a picture window that it becomes somehow valuable, and how the house participates as a bit of media to frame it and value it. So the house, of course, was facing this beautiful vista that was going to be the object of the idea of this project. And the house itself is in the shape of a kind of cornucopia. Mm-hmm. It starts very skinny at one end and widens at the other end and curves as it widens. And it's just the width of a door at one end where you come in. And it opens up and widens into an expansive view of the sea, sort of uninterrupted. And as it does so, it sort of frames it, and the program sort of adjusts to that, from the entrance to this arrival at this beautiful vista. At the same time, we wanted to produce the view through digital media. And so we had a camera that was perched looking at the view, sending a signal to a monitor that was exactly in front of the picture window, obscured part of it, and almost aligned where the horizon line of that same view was just slightly displaced, enough to cause irritation. And this project for us, that's kind of the essence. There was more to it, but it was about that conversation between the view through the picture window and the view on the monitor, and which was media, mm-hmm. you know, and it was a kind of rhetorical point in a way that both are, and both sort of frame value. And the one that's the digital one, we could actually record the weather and play good weather back in bad weather, and we could zoom in and have extra abilities. We can extend the ability of our sight, you know, to be binocular and to look deeper at things. And so we had sort of more agency in a certain way. But on the other hand, there was this other view that was still there and was valued by that frame. That was a really seminal project for us. And it started to be built.
So ahead of its time too, right? 15 years before the release of the iPhone, long before most people were on the internet even.
It's true. It's pretty early. I think because it somehow became, we started to build it, and there's a foundation in the ground. And the problem was that the client was selling two Cy Twombly paintings, and he was going to sell them to pay for the house. And that was when the art market sort of blew up, and he couldn't sell them. And then they were like, quote, burnt, which meant that he couldn't put them up at auction for a number of years. He had to wait. So in that time, he sort of lost it, had to go back to Japan. And we built the foundation, and we were fabricating off-site the components of the house to be brought, and we had to stop. So it was very heartbreaking. But there was so much attention somehow to this house because it was an idea that was published all over the place. It became iconic, and museums wanted to collect whatever we had of it. There's a bunch of things already in MoMA and in France at the FRAC and the FNAC. And so it sort of became legendary. And I feel like we did it already, but there's no one living in it, actually.
Yeah. And why Slow House? Where did that name come from?
You know, I think that the Slow House came from actually the geometry. So it was a spiral, which was a kind of expanding curve. That's part of the definition of this sort of geometry, was a slow curve. But also, the way you perceive it and the way you enter, it basically stretches this sort of threshold and connects the door, the front door, to the picture window. And everything between is a threshold where just the shape of the house and the cross section is sort of leaning in and in and in. And it sort of slows your pace, and it heightens your perceptions and sort of translates what you're about to see and makes it more meaningful.
So I want to circle back to, or go all the way back, let's mm-hmm. say, to Lodz, Poland, where you were born. And I understand you moved to this country around age 5, that mm-hmm. this was sort of a surprise that your family faced in you know, as a sort of anti-Semitic mm-hmm. Situation where you returned home and your home was boarded up and you had to leave. Do you have any memories from that time? Is there...
You know, my family has always lived a very secular existence. So, you know, but my parents actually survived the Holocaust mm. under other identities, but their families were wiped out. And when they decided to go back to Poland, it was to sort of reconstruct their lives. They had tried living in Paris, didn't work out. They went back to Poland. And actually, it wasn't really a happy existence for them, even though it was comfortable. My father was arrested all the time. And so it was, you know, I don't really quite remember it. I was pretty young. And they tried to get exit visas for a long time. And we had family in New York. So at some point, they were able to do it. And they just picked everything up and left. Mm. And, you know, the sort of comforts of upper middle class living in Poland, my father was running multiple factories, to coming and boxing groceries. And my mom was cleaning office buildings, you know. And so it was that. It was the immigrant story.
Yeah.
And, you know, they somehow shielded my brother and I from the difficulty of all of that. We grew up in a kind of middle class. You know, my father started to assimilate and then became a manager and of a hotel. And it was fairly comfortable.
And you were living in Greenwich Village. This was after moving here to Inwood in 1959.
That's right. So in 59, we came and moved to the Bronx first, lived there for a number of years, then moved to Inwood, and then a couple of different addresses. I have this really distinctive address that I don't think that anybody really believes that it exists, but it's the... corner of Cumming Street and Seaman Avenue. That's where I lived when I was in junior high. And then moved a little bit south. And then when I was in high school and then when I was in college, I moved south again to the Village, this time on my own. And I've been in the Village ever since. I haven't moved out.
And what was it like for you growing up in the Village at that time? I mean, this was probably... what, sort of late Jane Jacobs, maybe, or?
Well, I didn't get there. I'm trying to think. I probably moved around 70, I would say 77 or something like that. And, you know, this was a time when, well, first of all, everyone was shooting up. It was totally drug-filled. Everybody was in the streets. So it was like, it was a little bit hairy, I would say. You know, this was like the 70s, the late 70s, mid to late 70s, where there was just a lot of activities, you know, happening in the music scene and the art scene. So there was a lot going on, but it was a little dangerous, you know, and I felt like it was home. I mean, to me, I grew up sort of stepping over crack addicts, you know, just to get from school to home. So it was a pretty unusual time. And it was a little harsh, but that's the world I knew. And it was like New York was at its sort of richest in a way, sort of culturally, but it was also desperate. There were a lot of homeless people all over the place. Anyway, it was trying, but it was a great place to be and to get a sort of life education.
And were you thinking at all about buildings, about architecture at this time, or did that come later?
It came later. So, you know, I bring my family back into this whole equation. My mom, the one thing that she always told me was to get a great education and to be independent of men. You know, that was because she was dependent and she wanted me to not be. And so she was trying to get me to channel my artistic energies into a profession. In fact, it was her idea for me to go into architecture. Mm. And if not architecture, then dentistry.
So
you can imagine, you know, I mean, I saw these two things together and I thought, it's like root canal. Architecture would be like root canal. So I never even gave it a shot. And so when I was at Cooper Union and I transferred from art to architecture, I never told my parents because I didn't want to give them the satisfaction of...
You're somehow a little bit closer to being a doctor.
Exactly. Yeah, something like that. But as far as they knew, I was graduating with a degree in art that they thought was going to be totally useless. And when they came to graduation, they saw me pick up a degree in architecture and they were thrilled. But I warned them, I'm not going to really be an architect. It's just something I studied.
Yeah. So you go to Cooper Union, and that experience obviously led you to the path you're on now. Where, other than this architectonics class that you mentioned earlier, where did you find your sort of calling there? I know you took a class with Rick, for example, who became your partner in life and work.
Yeah. While I could say that my faculty was the inspiration, it wasn't really necessarily that. I think that Rick and John Haydock and others that I came into contact with helped me to read drawings, to think three-dimensionally, to think that there were crossovers between the discipline of architecture and other things. When I was a thesis student, I was reading Complexity and Contradiction in Architecture, Venturi, and this was forbidden in the architecture school. You know, there was like a blacklist of architects and references that you really couldn't refer to. I felt like I was trying to find an area, and at that time it was the whites and the grays, and you know, the grays represented all this kind of blurry stuff, and the whites were purist and the closest to conceptual art that you could find. And so I found the grays actually more interesting in a funny way. But picking up a lot of what was offered by people like Peter Eisenman and John Haydock, I think mostly them in that group. Mm. But trying to find an alternative path when I left architecture school, I immediately got a grant and a fellowship to go to Rome. And I did some traveling and some thinking, and then I was asked to teach at Cooper Union. And so it somehow looped back. But when I was there as a faculty member, I decided to experiment with sort of bringing other media into space making. And this was a time when there was an NEA and NISCA. It was possible to get project money for independent projects. So there were a lot of things that I wanted to explore, and Rick and I wanted to explore together as independently generated work and based on salaries from teaching and from these fellowships and grants. I was able to finance some of these projects, and most of them were also on credit card that I ended up having to pay off for next 10 years. But it allowed me to just have an outlet to do things. Like Traffic, which was one of the very first independent projects that Rick and I did in Columbus Circle, just repositioning like 2,500 traffic cones there and sort of moving traffic around and creating this field of color using an indigenous material to the site, traffic cones. Mm. And so from that, we started to experiment, and this led to commissions that came from sort of independent sources like Creative Time and Artist Space, which led to other commissions. And all of this time, I was really throwing grenades at the institution of the museum and the gallery in this institutional critique period of my life. And when we were actually invited into these institutions to do work, it sort of produced a problem, an ethical problem of how to do it, how to step into the institution and still have a critical voice. So a lot of the work that was created early and in book form and in the form of alternative work in gallery space or in public space was all independent agendas and self-initiated.
Mm. From what I understand, when Rick and you decided to come together and join forces as a firm, he was kind of frustrated with what was happening in architecture and leaning more toward other spheres. And you were coming from this sort of aspiring filmmaker into architecture. How and sort of why did you decide to create the firm with him? And what, how would you describe that early vision where between the two of you?
You know, I think when by the time I graduated and we were already a couple in secret at the time, because that wasn't really cool.
Yeah.
he had decided to leave the profession as he knew it, because he was already in a, he had been running a studio for a number of years, probably about 15 years prior. He didn't really find that much satisfaction out of it. And the relationship with me sort of expanded into research and into sort of testing new ideas. He was very happy to totally board all of that up and start a new life. When I started teaching at Cooper, we were both teaching side by side, and we were evolving this independent work together. And we were interested in issues like visuality, the culture of vision, you know, and all that that meant, including surveillance and voyeurism and exhibitionism and all sorts of the relationship between culture and vision, including perception. But we were also interested in tourism and cultural issues that were being explored, you know, in academic circles, sort of critical cultural issues, and bringing them into the fold. As space explorers.
Yeah, and one of your first, or if not, I would say the first that really kind of took, first project that took a lot of this academic thinking and brought it into the real world was the Blur Building in 2002, Lake Neuchâtel in Switzerland. Can you talk a little bit about that project? You were mentioning this sort of graying of architecture, and I was smiling thinking that your first real built work in that way was this Blur project that literally was an interpretation of that description, the blurring of.
Yeah, and it was probably the first really big public environmental project, and you could call it a building and you could call it a sculpture or a landscape environmental project. But it was basically a response to a competition to do something on Lake Neuchâtel in Switzerland for the Swiss Expo. And we had this idea to do something rather than next to this scenic lake, to do something right on the lake, in the lake, maybe 500 feet in, that used the material that was already there, the indigenous material, if you will, water, as a building material. And so this idea came to us to make a kind of fog bank that was produced out of water that was pumped out of the lake, filtered, and then shot through 35,000 mist nozzles that were suspended on the steel structure that you can actually walk from the shore along a long bridge into. And you would just basically be walking into this cloud. It was a vision that we had. And as often we have visions, we don't know exactly what they're about. You know, they're not necessarily a product of a logical thought stream. But there was an interest in testing vision as the master sense. Like, why are we so compelled? And why is architecture so much about vision? And very much inspired by Marcel Duchamp, really since the 80s, when we started to do work, and we did the Rotary Notary and her hot plate, which was about the delay in glass, one of Duchamp's seminal works, and which he used anti-retinal devices to actually create beautiful visual work that was, you know, just like pushing himself against the desire to make something aesthetic, but do it through chance. So, you know, this approach was really channeled into a lot of future work. And the experiment with the Blur Building was to limit vision, to produce a space where you really couldn't see much and you were dependent on the other senses. So sound and smell and touch and taste. And so what would this be like? And this cloud, which was not really defined, it was defined as blur, which is defocused vision. So usually you use it as a kind of negative term, like, you know, like a blurry shot on your camera is something that isn't operating, you know, the lens isn't operating right. So, but we thought about this as a positive thing, like a motion blur, for example, is something that you construct to express movement. So we wanted to create a space that was a blur that you could actually inhabit, where you couldn't sense depth, you couldn't sense dimension. You were just kind of lost in this medium that you had to somehow now move around in. But it was luminous. It wasn't like a dark room. Mm-hmm. So it was filled with light. And there was some kind of weird effect called the ion effect, which, you know, might be pseudoscientific, but you sort of feel great, you know, when breathing this kind of air. That's this very, very fine mist. You sometimes get it next to a fountain, this ion effect. It's kind of euphoria. So we produced this at a huge level. It was the size of a football field, and there were no walls, and it was just this floating platform, couple of platforms, and you could get out onto it, and it held hundreds of people that could be moving in every direction. But there was this basically exposition pavilion in a Swiss expo where there was really nothing to see and nothing to do but to contemplate our dependence on vision.
It's so interesting in the context of, you know, your work now, of course, but even just right then, you had another project that was very much about viewing that you'd done in collaboration with David Rockwell. It was as a viewing platform at the World Trade Center site.
Yeah. So after 9/11, there was a kind of call to action of a lot of people in the professional world just coming down and sort of coming to the aid of whoever needed, like the rescue effort, you know, and even feeding the, you know, chefs came to feed the firefighters and the rescuers. And we sort of, there was this very, very curious desire, natural desire to see the wreckage, you know, and it wasn't perverse, really. It was, you know, because that the towers were no longer there. Mm-hmm. And people just couldn't really make sense out of the site and wanted to go there, but you couldn't because there were barricades. So we had this instinct to sort of build a viewing platform that was ramping from the street up in the air and would create a perch for the public to be able to bear witness without getting in the way of the cleanup, the rescue and the cleanup effort. And during that time, it was very hard to get the attention of anyone in the city, but we were able to work enough with the city to enable us to make this 300-foot long ramp. And we made a little foundation to raise the money and to build this. It was nobody else's concern. We just did it. And it became really, really popular. And there was a big line to get up and see it from an elevated standpoint. And I think that it performed a kind of task and got us involved with this whole effort. So we did that project together. And after that, we were thinking, well, what else could we do together? And
now the shed.
Well, the shed was like came much, much afterwards. So in 2008, David knew some folks at Related, which was the developer that was to develop the site later. We knew some people from the city, and we had heard that there was this RFP that was going to come out and to really imagine like some kind of new cultural facility at Hudson Yards, which was going to be developed as this sort of mega development project. And David and I, one day, we just happened to be in the same place at the same time. We were talking about this, and we decided we would have twice as much chance of getting it if we teamed up. So that was sort of the beginning of that. We put it together, a kind of loose proposal with a little manifesto, submitted it, and the city thought this was actually a good marriage. And
and this is before any real institution, before Alex Poots is involved.
Oh, way before. This is in 2008, and it's at the height of the financial crisis. So it seemed totally improbable that anything would ever happen. And we were really surprised. So in Hudson Yards, which is this mega, you know, huge development, there was a square of property, not very much space, about 21,000 square foot footprint, but somehow could grow to about 150 to 200,000 square feet. And all there was were the words cultural facility. That's it. And there was some discussion about some kind of flexible thing that didn't replicate anything that was already in New York, but was something different. That's it. So, you know, this was an RFP that was really for a cultural entity, like some, you know, or maybe this, some of the city's institutions wanted to expand or have a new wing or something like that. They could do it there. Or there were new ideas by cultural leaders that wanted to make some kind of new institution. This was a kind of unusual thing that architects would sort of go after something like this, but we did. And the first conversations sort of led to different kinds of options, like, you know, what does culture mean anyway? Can it mean science? Can it mean design, fashion, culinary arts, all sorts of things. And now in the first like 3 months, we were flipping ideas back and forth. And then, you know, ultimately there was a first sketch. I remember this first sketch, and it was like how to expand the footprint of, because 21,000 square feet wasn't very much. And there was an open space next to us. And we thought, well, what if we could use it part of the time? That would allow us to have a much bigger footprint. And there was a certain point where this sort of evolution of this idea of the building sort of landed in DSNR studio. Mm-hmm. And we were evolving it as a kind of, you know, at that point, getting more and more definition as a new experimental arts facility that would bring all sorts of creative disciplines under one roof, which would mean, like, you know, this city is filled with cultural institutions, whether they be visual arts like galleries and museums, or performing arts like Lincoln Center, or theaters, or dance theaters, you know. And it's so siloed in New York, like how the arts are subdivided into various categories: theater from dance, from opera, from orchestral music. Mm-hmm. So we have these different houses that specialize in different things. But aside from what was happening at the Armory, which was starting at that time, there was no purpose-built, flexible entity that would embrace all the cultural disciplines in one space. And so we started this project without a client. And it was a kind of a hunch that, you know, this expandable building that could actually utilize the adjoining space, that could mount various shows, installations, performances at various scales. It could be intimate. They could be extra large. That could be so flexible. This institution could be so flexible that it would also have a flexible footprint. That was a kind of new thing. That was a new contribution. But that is a unusual thing that was possible in that site. But even before that, it was, the question was, what will artists be doing in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years? There's no way to know.
Right.
So the idea was to make a kind of architecture of infrastructure, which meant really robust, a lot of loading capacity for heavy things that were going to be suspended or that were going to grow out of the floor, electrical loading capacity for, you know, driving any kind of media and a lot of it, and the ability to control light and the ability to control sound. Those were the sort of basic irreducibles, and to have enough space and to protect it. And this was really the key thing, to protect that space that the city had the vision to defend right from the beginning, because the shed sits on city property, which is entirely sovereign. And even though it's in the four corners of the development, it's not subject to anything of the development. It's its own site that could do its own thing.
And in a project that has had its fair share of detractors. And
yes.
I think it's somehow managed to become a sort of shining example of good within a larger evil, perhaps.
You know, I think when this city originally thought about it, and when the zoning changed and it enabled a large project to happen there, and also the technologies of building over Hudson Yards was evolved, you know, and Related actually did some really smart things for being able to build a deck and be over 35 live tracks, you know, that had to keep going. You couldn't stop anything when you built. So there were some innovations, and the zoning had changed, which enabled all of that. The city, in its wisdom, said, well, if the city's going to grow, culture should grow with it, and therefore made sure that there was a space for culture. I don't think anybody anticipated what it would ultimately be, the backdrop for the project. But, you know, we saw it always, and as we saw it evolve, then we also became involved in the
Tower.
15 Hudson Yards, which is the adjoining property, first in self-defense, because
I believe you described it as our deal with the devil.
I said that someplace. It got me into trouble. But, you know, I think that in the end, our mature selves said, we wanted a good neighbor. And wouldn't it be interesting to contribute to the skyline, to have an opportunity to do something that really wasn't natural to our studio, to do a commercial project like that. But it was a kind of maybe a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to do that. And here, what we could do is make an ensemble, even though they're totally different projects, different clients that happen to conjoin. If we were the architects of both, then we could argue back and forth and always win an argument.
You don't have to deal with the tower builder.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And likely not to be someone that would release more space or allow us to do things that we ended up doing, like producing these cantilevers so the building, the shed could dock right into the bottom of the tower. We picked up 10 floors of back-of-house space of the lower portion of the tower that was less valuable to the developer, and we were able to situate our large freight elevator in that footprint. We were able to do a lot of things to protect the space that we had for cultural use, for explicitly that, and not taking it for offices or any of other bathrooms, storage, you know, green rooms, all the different things that support the spaces for culture and the public. We were able to tuck away our mechanical equipment, all of that. So that was actually a smart idea.
Yeah. And how do you feel about the result now that you see it in real life? I mean, obviously there's complications with the site. You have Thomas Heatherwick's vessel nested so close to the shed, but it's functioning. The shed is, and it's there. So
I like to think about what we had control over, which is the tower and the shed, and what we're able to do there in a positive light. You know, we could have never done this project anywhere else. It was because there was a site, and because it was open on three sides, and we actually had a fourth side that we could control, that we were able to imagine a brand new kind of cultural facility that, you know, an infill site in Manhattan, forget it. It could never, ever have happened. So it was sheer opportunism, I think, in the end, that brought us there. There was this RFP that, oh, this is a really cool idea to imagine. And the city thought, you know, because by the way, for the first 3 years were relatively unfunded. that we were the first, probably the first contributors to the Shed. We proved out that this idea could actually exist from an engineering standpoint, from a programmatic standpoint. We worked with lots of cultural leaders from all over New York to get their best wisdom. So we worked with the Guggenheim and BAM and Tribeca Film Festival and the Whitney and all sorts of other entities to sort of give us feedback to what we were doing, and some with real sort of technical criteria. Mm. And there was a lot of discourse.
That seems so generous in a city.
It was extraordinary.
Yeah, there's so much competition, I think.
I think that, you know, in the end, there is a lot of competition for donors. But the Shed was going to do something that, you know, that wasn't really what anybody else was doing in New York. I think the closest is the Armory. And I think that there's enough room for two institutions that are similar. Alex is doing something really unusual. So Alex came, we started in 2008. Alex was hired in 2014.
The director of the Shed.
Yes. Alex Poots, brilliant director of the Shed. And before that, Dan Doktoroff, who was the deputy mayor and was already no longer in government, but it was in the private sector, was a kind of fantastic mentor, and he became the chairman of the board. He made this whole thing really ultimately happen. And it was in this transition between 2008 and 2011, when we were more autonomous, working with the Hudson Yards Development Project, which was basically a small arm of the city that was doing public art in the subway and in Hudson Yards, made sure that the city's interests were preserved. So those were the only people we interacted with. So as I said, we were the clients, and started to work with Dan more intensely in 2011 and 2012. And then the Shed became, it was still called the Culture Shed at that time, it became an independent not-for-profit with Dan as the chair, and he started to build a board. So that was the first time we actually had a contract in 2012. And so it was a kind of, you know, we sort of willed this all, this group of people that were very pioneering, Dan and a group of people that he started to assemble around the project, to give this whole thing credibility and to start to get capital money into this. And around 2013-14, there was this, you know, okay, now there needs to be a leader. Somebody needs to be hired. And there was an international search where Alex was selected as the obvious choice. And he was sort of magical, though his proposal and his thoughts were really in sync with the ethos of the Shed, what we had already done. This was already a building. We had been building foundations, you know, producing steel already at that time, because we had to keep up with the infrastructure that was being built at Hudson Yards. So when Alex came in as artistic director and CEO, he had already had great success at the Manchester Festival, doing experimental work across disciplines. And now he sort of felt like, wow, this is an opportunity to do not only a festival that lasted 2 weeks, but 360 days a year. He was very interested in the possibility of what this building could also deliver for him.
And in a way, it was an architectural cue to building the institution. Normally, it's kind of coming the other way around. You're building the institution, you have the collection, then you make the building.
Exactly.
In this case, it was actually architecture leading the way to the...
Yeah. And it was the only way it could have happened because of just this RFP. There was no... It was 2008. What institution would, in their right mind, actually step into a new bricks and mortar project put to situate there? At that time when nobody even knew how much money they had in the bank.
Yeah.
So it started off as this sort of theoretical idea and ended up having a lot of traction. But it was pretty much in the third or fourth month that this idea started to sort of have a sort of visual component to it, this moving shed. At first, there were four telescoping pieces It was much bigger, and it, you know, and but it, as it matured and grew, and as time went on, it became a little bit more humble. And there was just one fixed building with multiple levels of galleries and performance spaces, and this telescoping outer shell that would double its footprint. And that was enough. And then we were oriented at once to the north, and then we were oriented to the east. And, you know, it always made sense. It was always the same sort of argument, which was, if you don't have to program it with extra large programming, you don't need to deploy it, and you don't need to heat it and cool it or be obligated to programming it. You could just simply nest it and open up a big open public space, open to the sky, that you can also create outdoor programming for. So it was an idea that seemed to take. And the actual technology for it was really, really simple. Seems complicated, seems spectacular, but it's just a gantry crane that was made into a building that has seals so that you can basically thermally control it as a building, just like any building. But you can also sort of move it out of the way. And using just very simple rack and pinion system and the horsepower of one Prius engine to move the whole thing. And it only takes 5 minutes.
Yeah. And speaking of architecture that moves, the High Line is linked directly to this site, the High Line, of course, which your firm worked on and was a lead designer on. Could you talk about everything you were learning in the building of the High Line, knowing the site of where the shed was going to go and understanding the cultural significance, the social significance, how the High Line was just reshaping this neighborhood? Did that feed the shed at all?
Yeah, I think that there was a set of unanticipated consequences. So when we started the High Line with James Corner and Pete Udolph as collaborators, we anticipated, you know, maybe 400,000 people a year would come. And this was basically the pitch to the city that needed to be convinced to save the High Line, because after all, Giuliani, as his outgoing act as mayor, signed a demolition order to tear it down. And Mike Bloomberg, under pressure from people like Amanda Burden, who's his planning commissioner, was convinced to give it a try, to let the idea sort of come out. And Robert Hammond and Josh David were like brilliant young citizen activists that just had this vision to turn it into a park. It wasn't really ours. So we did a competition in 2004, I believe maybe 2003 to 2004, with James. And this was an international competition from a field of architects, where our idea was just to make it habitable. You know, this like fantastic new environment and set of micro environments that happened in a very perverse way with windblown seeds or seeds that came off of railway cars that came off of the High Line as an industrial piece of infrastructure, sort of got rooted into the ballast. And all these weird things grew when it became a ruin. You know, in 1980, it was abandoned, and then it became this kind of overgrown ruin. So we were very inspired by that and decided to take it the next step. Like, how do you preserve that otherworldly sensibility, bring the public up there, and have humans and vegetation coexist in a new way, in a new form, which gave birth to this paving system and this meandering path and the, you know, the combing together of these systems and the
now,
different...
Now 8 million tourists.
And so, yes. So fast forward from when we opened the first chunk of the High Line that went to 20th Street, and that was in 2009. Already, there was this weird effect going on where the properties all around the area, knowing that there was going to be this park, and the park was, you know, understood already, those properties were being traded and flipped already. When the High Line opens in 2009, it becomes a really big hit. New Yorkers love it. And it starts to sort of feed into our sort of imagination, our cultural imagination about the city and its roots as this post-industrial city, and looking back sort of nostalgically at this past that the meatpacking district was really disappearing. So this industrial past that was disappearing it before our eyes because all of these plants are moved away. And the area was a sea of open parking lots. And then there was this sort of future that we didn't really know what it could be. But it was a new, an alternative park, a new way of seeing New York, a way of seeing the city's subconscious in a way.
Like the work we talked about before, about a view.
Yeah, it was views, but it was onto what would be normally thought of as unsightly things. Mm. Because we were looking at basically the party walls of buildings that wanted to build away from the High Line, because the High Line was this industrial piece of infrastructure. It made noise. It was ugly. You know, at least that was what was the perception was. All of a sudden, the High Line was marketable and was a real park that started to create this sort of desire to look at it. And mm-hmm. all of these new glassy buildings started to shoot up like blades of glass. And there was this, what I think of as a phototropic effect, like sunflowers following the sun. Mm. These buildings that were normally turn away from that were just like,
interesting.
You know,
yeah.
You're just leaning in to look at it. And if you, you know, like the advertisements, everybody wanted to use the High Line in their
right.
names, and we couldn't.
HL23.
Exactly. You could, like every possible variety, you know, variation on the use of the name was used in everything. And nobody could defend it because yeah. it was not copyrightable.
But it showed a lot about the power of good design, good infrastructure, rethinking, similar to what, you know, Frank Gehry's Bilbao kind of did from this sort of yeah. institutional point of view in 1997. Here you had a park that was reshaping not just one institution or one corner of a city, but an entire neighborhood, blocks.
Yeah. You know, we didn't realize it would have that kind of catalytic effect. We thought that, and the argument of growth was very much in there, because you can't pitch a cultural or civic project to a city without talking about economic development. You know, it's just, at least in a real estate driven city like New York, there always had to be an argument like that. So the argument was about the growth of this area of Manhattan, which was pretty much empty. You know, we remember some of the leather clubs and things like that that were cool and interesting, but they were not going to survive for very long. And how a part of the city could evolve, how it could develop. And this park was going to be a great asset in that growth, because there's no green space in the area. And this sort of prospect of bringing, you know, that many people, hundreds of thousands of people there to this kind of unusual area to see Manhattan in a new way, you know, and to be able to walk without stopping for a traffic light for a distance. So the park caught on, and we were starting to design part two from 20th Street to 30th Street. And it was already obvious that the park was going to do more. It was going to catalyze the area. So property values started to escalate. At the same time, the High Line started to inspire other cities to do similar things. So there was this viral effect of the High Line in global cities everywhere, worldwide, to create public space out of obsolete infrastructure.
Yeah. even the Low Line in New York. I mean, these.
Yeah, every variation that you could possibly think of. And a lot of them were totally legitimate. But even like weird ones, like building a new bridge across the Thames called the Garden Bridge that Thomas Heatherwick was responsible yeah. for, and using the High Line as a kind of example of a success of a piece of infrastructure as a park. But that was totally a misuse of the reference, because the High Line was so important a reference because it was already there. And it was an adaptive reuse. Mm-hmm. And it was a way of thinking sustainably in an environment where we have limited resources globally, and we're all having to deal with this. And this was a kind of great way of bringing people together to do something that was very old-fashioned, walking and sitting. You know, there's not much you can do there. You can't really throw baseballs around, and you can't bring a bike or a dog. So you can walk and sit. But this was like a total discovery for New Yorkers, the notion about doing nothing. And I sort of, you know, love that sort of idea, because we're so productive by nature, being urbanites. We're either working, and when we're not working, we're burning calories on a treadmill, and we're not doing that. We're spending money in a store, or, you know, we're always doing something. But the idea of carving out time to really truly do nothing is a kind of invention for New York. And so that, I have to say, is, I think, part of it. It's something, it's like rediscovering something very, very old-fashioned, like walking, looking at people, and not using devices. I mean, when you go to the High Line, people don't really go on their devices. So it's a kind of parenthesis in your day.
Mm. I want to close on the MoMA project, because I think it's interesting that early in your career, you were critiquing the very kind of institution that you're now designing for. Have you thought about how to deal with that contrast, bringing in maybe some of those ideas, those very critiques that you had, in terms of how you're thinking about the future of this institution, how you're handling that particular project?
It's actually a pretty interesting history for us, because we were invited to do the first projects room series as an architect. But, you know, before us, there were artists. But this is a commissioning project, and we did this piece called Parasite, where you're commissioned to enter a gallery and do an original new piece of work. And the institution doesn't know what you're doing before you do it. It was a fantastic opportunity. And of course, we took it. And this was way back. I can't even remember the year. But early part of our career, where we came in and we started ripping the institution apart. And we started looking, you know, all this meta sort of approach to inhabiting a place that we were also critical of. At some point along the way in our career, our first museum project was the ICA, actually.
In Boston.
And it was the first time we contended with the issue of what happens now for us when we started off as the critics of the institution. Now we had to speak in the voice of the institution. What happens? We decided at that point that, you know, because the invitation came from someone that was my age, a woman, you know, who basically was critical of past institutions as well, that let's take this trip and let's do it. There was a huge maturing process. And I think very much thinking about making a new institution for artists to be able to re-script, to be able to do things that they couldn't ordinarily do in other kinds of museums, typical museums. It was sort of, you know, an opportunity to think about architecture as also being a contributor to the culture of architecture. So it had a role. And this was, you know, after Bilbao, where there was this whole debate about, is architecture the protagonist, you know, that it makes sort of an icon and the art is secondary to the building that happened in Bilbao? Or is architecture a kind of background player and put art first? And our studio thought that that was a ridiculous argument. It was neither of those. It was collaborative, and it had to contribute as space making at the time of its execution, but it also had to sort of turn the dial back in terms of the volume of the architect's voice and allow other voices to emerge, the voices of artists, curators, and creative people. And so the ICA was the first museum. Fast forward to MoMA. So we come back to MoMA now, and we have the opportunity to make a change there. So we were there as dissidents originally, now being able to change MoMA for the better. And in our interview with the leadership of MoMA, we were quite critical of a bunch of things. One was that art was so far from the street. The public realm was kind of not really contended with. It was the post-Taniguchi period, and there were things that went right with that project. You know, there were some nice things that Taniguchi did, but there were other things that we thought could be done in a different way. And we sort of brought up some of these issues to the leadership, and they decided, of all the people that they interviewed, which I still don't know, that we were the ones they wanted to go ahead with. So we sort of went in with our eyes wide open. And
well, you had to, right?
We had to. And MoMA was interested in doing some new things, like bringing more of their collection out, you know, because they were severely cramped. You know, even though they had done all these expansions, the proportion of public space or space for other functions to gallery space was disproportionately small, the gallery space itself. So while MoMA was growing and growing, there wasn't that much space ultimately to grow into for their gallery space. So one of the principal things in this expansion was to actually pick up a lot of gallery space. And it was to put into the public sphere, you know, this, they have an incredible collection, but only a very small percentage of it sees the light of day. And the curators, a new set of curators, really forward thinking, they wanted to tell the story of modernism in new ways. There wasn't one story. And they were working across disciplines as well. So this very old-fashioned idea of the department store, you know, with different disciplines per floor, was going to be shaken up in a new way. So we would be a part of that change. And that was one of the forward-thinking things that we were sort of engaged with, that was led by the curators and Glenn Lowry. And at the same time, we thought that, well, what kind of galleries? You know, we thought that there could be some new kinds of galleries that MoMA didn't even know that it needed. There was an opportunity to shape the public sphere, the public realm, pre-ticketed on the ground floor, which was really beautiful because you have this fantastic garden, sculpture garden, and the way that the public interacted with it, it was really, that garden was usually used by people that already had tickets. So there were some changes about to happen. We got involved, and there was a big effort to sort of rethink everything. So while the expansion was to the west, we couldn't just add another arm to this organism without drawing the blood, you know, from the heart and the brain in a different way. So the whole organism had to be rethought. And that was...
Here you are talking about architecture like a doctor.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we had to do a lot of surgery, so my mom
would be proud.
Your
parents would be proud.
But it was, you know, in a way, there was a lot of selfless work in this because we knew a lot of it would be buried. A lot of it would be changing all the mechanical systems where you sort of try to do something like add extra elevators or stairs, you know, in this new wing. And in order to do that, you have to move everything around in order to get the ticketing out of, like, the front door, just where it was before. You need to move a lot of things around and a lot of logics that were there before you got there. So it was immensely complex.
And then you have the larger sort of cultural critics and art critics and architecture critics and just... critics.
Well, there was not a lot of goodwill toward this effort, and the Folk Art Museum was part of all of that. And, you know, in the end, it was something that we worked on for a while to try to figure out how to incorporate it. There was no good solution, and then somehow we got blamed. And it was a horrible time in my life and Rick's life and all that, when we were just all the anger that people had at everything, Midtown zoning, glass buildings, the power of MoMA, you know, everything was just brought to this project. And it was very, very hard for us because we were critical of MoMA as well. And we were trying to figure out how to, you know, nobody wants to tear down a building. Nobody wants to be involved in. And that decision was made before we got through the front door. But our first instinct was to try to find a way of saving things that are already there. You know, in the end, when I look back on that period, it was brutal, but we got through it. And the project really got very smart. And we opened a piece of it last year. And what was that, the year before? I can't quite remember. It's amazing to be able to do two major institutional projects. Oh, and Lincoln Center, by the way.
Yeah.
Another large
place. Can't forget that
place.
One.
Yeah. A decade of our lives. But I think that we were sort of beneficiaries of the Bloomberg administration that had a very big cultural bent and a lot of really, really interesting pioneering people that were part of that administration that listened. There were these opportunities that were opened up that we could step into. We were in the right place at the right time.
And clearly with partners who weren't afraid to take a risk with you.
No. Rick was always game, and Charles Renfro came in as a staff member and then became a partner. And Ben Gilmartin, that also worked on Lincoln Center as a leader of that project, one of the leaders of the project, that became a partner a little bit later. Basically, the four of us as partners were able to do so much work. And now we're working around the globe, but we still have this incredible passion to change our own cities, our own city, because we are actually the citizens here that get to use these places. And we know our own city better than we know any other part of the world. So in a way, stepping into Moscow or even London or Rio or
Hungary.
Or Budapest or, Tianjin and, you know, other places that we're building, Adelaide. You know, we're visitors, basically visitors to these other cultures and parachuting in and sort of pretending that there's a global idea, you know, that can be exported. We actually believe in doing research and trying to understand where we are before we even make a move. But those are all sort of great opportunities to extend some of these logics and bring in local logics as well and try to make new things. But New York is ultimately the place where I live, and I want to go to Lincoln Center to hear a concert. I'm going to want to go to the Shed to see an installation, or to MoMA to see an exhibition or hear a lecture or something like that. Go to the High Line, take a walk. And it's really terrifying, you know, to think that, my God, you know, like the whole city's a punch list, you know, where I see all these things that haven't been finished that are, you know, maybe not kept up as well as perfectly as they could be or changed, you know. And it's kind of an interesting thing to live through because those kind of transformations of places that I'm going to actually live through. So far, so good. It kind of like as intended. But, you know, I'm sure in 10 years, there's going to be all sorts of new uses. And I'm not going to, you know, I don't know whether I'm going to feel great about it. But it's like giving up this baby, these children, you know, all over the place. And, you know, for others to interpret and take forward.
Liz, this is great. Thanks so much for coming here today.
Thank you. Fun conversation. Thanks for the therapy.
Thanks for listening. You can find more episodes of the Time Sensitive podcast on our website, timesensitive.fm, or on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv.